Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 86 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, I chatted with Dr. Sarah Beckman, a professor of classics at UCLA. She's a Roman archaeologist who specializes in domestic art. Other research interests include the sculpture habit of late antiquity, portrait traditions in provincial contexts, representations of women and enslaved children in domestic arts, and the creation of aesthetic space in the Levant between the 4th and 5th century CE. At present, she works primarily with archival material and with the recovery and analysis of legacy data, but she has also excavated throughout the Western Mediterranean in Greece, Italy, and France. She is currently working on a monograph which reinvestigates the villa phenomenon of the late antique period from the mid-3rd to the 5th century CE. In this episode, we discuss comparisons between Rome and America, examine Roman domestic art, shrines, and cult practices, and explore the universal nature of religion, spirituality in the ancient world, and the challenges of communicating them in the modern era. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give our show a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy!
Great. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'm super excited about this conversation, and so I want to get us started right away and ask you what I hope will be a really easy question for you, which is, when did you first get into the ancient world? Were you a kid? Were you high school age?
Yeah. Great question. So first, Lexi, thanks for having me. There are moments that I remember. So first, as a kid, we had one of, you know, your regular books that like my mom or dad would read. And like, there's the regular books, there's the board books. And then we had like a few bigger books that were like coffee table style books. And one of the bigger books was this, I mean, I think it was like Dodelaire's Greek Myths or something, and had these illustrations that I thought were like, they were so beautiful, but they were also weird. They didn't look like my other books or their illustrations. And that's how I got into myths. And some of the pictures, like there's one, you know, like the way Hercules is fighting the monsters, they like turned me off, but also I thought it was really cool. And so that's my first memory, basically. And then when I got to college, I was one of those people, I didn't have a declared major. I was at a liberal arts school. I went to Carleton College. I was thinking I was going to go into medicine, right? I feel like this is a lot of people. You're going to do med, you're going to do law, something like that. And I remember I took a Spanish course because I loved language. And then I got to the level where I'd completed the necessary language requirements. And I was like, I want to start a new language. And one of the few that was available to start in the winter quarter was Latin. And I was like, oh, well, I love myth, right? There's Ovid. Like, I'll learn to read Ovid. And I took Latin 101, and I realized then it takes a while to learn Latin. So it was a while before I read myth. I really enjoyed that. I started taking Greek. And then I think the real turning point for me was in my my third year of college. I did a study abroad program in Rome. So it was through the Intercollegiate Center of Classical Studies, which is like one of these abroad programs that students from any university can apply to. So you meet people from different places. It was like the first time I realized that there was stuff as part of this world. Like I knew about the Colosseum, things like that, But we got there and I'd just been learning languages. And then all of a sudden there's this like city with like layers and layers of history that you can just see. And I found it like so, I don't know, moving and powerful and overwhelming. And that's kind of like what got me interested in like the art archaeology part of it. And that moment being in Rome, kind of like thinking in that city, trying to figure out like who I was as a person, like midway through my college career and like what I was doing with my studies, that really turned me on the path of like material culture studies. So that's my little journey, I guess.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, that's awesome. I love hearing everyone's personal journey into, you know, like such a kind of niche subject that a lot of people will, you know, spend 2 seconds on and be like, okay, that's cool. Yeah, right, I wouldn't want to do that as a job, but like, nice. So, you know, it's fun to hear what everyone's sort of entry point is.
Yeah.
So did you have like, were your parents generally supportive of you going into this, or were they kind of, was there that like, you know, sort of skeptical, like, are you sure? Don't you want to like major in like economics or something that will make you money?
Oh, that's a good question. So like, I'm the oldest in my family. So there were no previous like siblings who'd gone through, who didn't know what they were going to do with their job afterwards or something. So that was easy. So both my parents actually went on in medicine, but neither of them majored. I mean, there's no major in medicine, right? Like there's no thing that you have to do. So they were very good at like encouraging me to just explore, take classes and things I was interested in. And then I was like, when I was like, I want to go to Rome, of course, they were like, oh, that's really cool. Like, you should do that. Neither of them had ever studied abroad. So it was this kind of like, that sounds amazing. And I think there was never any pushback when like, so I finished, I got a degree in classical languages. I moved to Chicago. I worked for 2 years. And then the second year I started applying for graduate school because I was kind of thinking I want to work in museums, but I sort of realized to work in museums in the way that I found really interesting, it sounded like whatever you wanted to do, you'd probably need either an advanced degree or you'd need to have gotten in much earlier than I did. So I was like, I'm going to have to go the advanced degree route. I thought like, okay, I want to do either, and this was all based on Rome, I want to do either ancient art or I want to do the reception of ancient art, like in, I don't know, the Italian Renaissance or something. And I remember telling this to my parents and they were like, okay. In the kind of like, well, and then when I said also like, I'm applying for programs that are funded too. Like if you get into some of these grad programs, they pay you to study this stuff. And they're like, oh, that's great. You know, I think it's that kind of thing where in some ways it's good to have a family support system that just supports you, that are, they have no idea what this field looks like or what the job prospects are. And in some ways that was easier. I think if they'd actually known that there aren't a lot of jobs and that's hard to get one, they might've been a little more, not necessarily pushed back, but wanted me to think about it more. But no, they were pretty supportive the whole time. And I do think I benefited being the oldest. Like I'd been held to certain standards that I feel like they really slacked off for my younger sister. So I was allowed to do what I wanted to do because I'd been good so far. Like there's, I don't know, but yeah, they were supportive and no real pushback. I do think also, just to continue on that, I think I benefited from the, and I think there's still, I think classics or like study of the Greek and Roman world, I think it still has this kind of like standing in academics, like, oh, that's like what people have studied for years. That's a good field to get into. That's like prestigious. It's elitist, I think, honestly, in a bad way. So my parents were pretty supportive of that because that's what people have done. The elite people have done for a long, long time. So I benefited from that. And of course, there are issues with that that I think we're only reckoning with now.
It is one of those weird fields where, yes, it has the benefit of being looked at as a very old, ancient subject that makes sense if you're into like studying, you know, just it's a good thing for the humanities. But it's one of those things that it has prestige in the name and the facade.
Yes.
But underneath that is like the, you will probably not get a great job and you'll have to adjunct, you'll have to move a lot and
you're
never going to accrue wealth like your grandparents' generation.
Yeah. Well, and then although I've changed into this person who thinks like, I think that's just what's happening with, I forget if I'm like Gen X or Gen Z or whatever. I think like my generation is the first generation that's not going to make more than their parents or something. Like, there's just not great jobs out there for any of us. Like, so that's like, I honestly think you should still go into what you're interested in, follow that passion and start thinking at the same time, like what you study is not necessarily what you'll be employed to do, but there are ways to do both, I think. And I love being a professor. I really enjoy it right now, but I still have moments where I think like, gosh, what if I worked, I think a part of me would be happy, like being a nurse or something, or like having a 9-to-5 like office job. And then I could go home and just like read these same books for fun, like not because they're work, you know? So I do think, like, I don't know, I wish there was some larger kind of sociocultural changes in the United States where like finding a job was easier, whatever field you wanted to go into. So
no, I agree. There's definitely, I mean, going into classics taught me that I love reading, but also then reading became a chore and it wasn't as fun just because there was so much to read, which is, funnily enough, why people were like, oh, well, there would be less to read if you went into material culture and didn't want to go toward philology.
It's more. It's just, and it's in like, I don't know, there's like so many of those catalogs of objects found, like reading an excavation report is, I mean, I enjoy it. Sometimes it can be tiring. Yeah. You got to know how to look. You have to know your foreign language as well and like what to look for. So I do think material culture archaeology gets kind of like this bad rap as the easy way to go, but it is not at all, because weirdly, it's this field where you have to prove to everyone you can do the languages and the history too, even though you do the archaeology. So all fields, it's a lot of reading.
you can thank Indiana Jones also for like a very skewed look at your field, because what is the famous, the funny saying we like to say about Indy, which is he is the most famous archaeologist who doesn't do archaeology.
Yes. No, it's totally true. Totally true.
But you know, I'm curious, and I think it's a general curiosity, just because I seem to find myself asking every Romanist, every Latinist that I talk to, because I am such a Hellenist that for me, I actually, it's so embarrassing to admit now, but in undergrad, I was always the person who was like, I want to avoid every single class on Rome that I can. I do not want to take anything about the Romans, but there was like a required, you have to take like a class on the Romans. And I was like, fine, I'll take Rome 1 or whatever. But then I was like, never again. And so for me, it's like a personal fascination. So what drove you to Rome and not Greece? And I wonder, is it that you found Rome first and your first love is what you settled on? Or is it like that they just happen to fascinate you more than the Greek side?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So I think going to Rome was big for me, and like kind of seeing that city and feeling like I'd spent a part of my life in that city. I felt somehow connected to it in that way that I'm not really, but I felt like, oh, that was a moment of my life that I spent there. I think the other thing is I started with Latin. So that was kind of like in my head first. And the thing that has always drawn me to the Roman world is it is a little later. So as you were talking, like, okay, studying the Greek world in comparison to Egypt, like you're much younger, like Rome is also younger, but I think it recognizes in some ways that it is younger in this ancient Mediterranean world, and it deals with that kind of like feeling or something. And in the back of my head, I lived in Chicago, which was like so-called second city, and the kind of like having to deal with all these other ancient cultures. I found that kind of attractive about studying Rome. And then I also love that the longer the Roman period goes on, like it spreads all over, sort of far beyond the Mediterranean. And there's so many different places and cultural groups and social groups that are part of Roman culture. So it feels like a place, if you want to study children, if you want to study women, if you want to study the enslaved, if you want to study like foreign identities, plural, within, or religious identities within this larger kind of Roman thing, you can do it. And so I was drawn to that. It seems like there's more inscriptions, there's more stuff, there's more literature, there's just a lot of stuff to work with, which is sometimes why I find it overwhelming, but ultimately very satisfying. I think in graduate school, I know sometimes there's the problem of historical anachronism, and you know, sometimes we use these thinking tools, but a part of me likes to play with the Roman world as like, it helps me kind of understand like US culture or like American culture, and that it's supposed to mean this one thing, but it looks very different depending on who you are, how you identify, where you grow up, where you've been. And I think that's true of the Roman world too. And I think archaeology is the best way to show that. So you have to kind of push back through the texts written by the 1% and see what the material kind of legacy tells you. And it sometimes doesn't say things quite as crystal clear, but you get a more nuanced, more detailed, like kind of more diverse sense of what Roman means. And I was really drawn to that. And as a Romanist, like, no disrespect to the Hellenists, but I've always found the kind of like the Greek miracle thing to be like, well, that's not true. Like, they borrow that stuff from the East and then the Romans borrow it from the Greeks. It's just like, that's how it works. So I feel like Greek culture sometimes gets tied up in like 5th century Athens, which is great in some ways, but there's so much more of that. And I know that's something like Hellenists are wrestling with, but in the Roman world, I think we have Roman Beyond and have been doing that for a while. So it feels like a comfortable place to be kind of exploring like the fringes of Roman identity or Roman culture. Yeah.
Wow. Well, you've succeeded in just doing something that I don't think any, and I really want to stress that anyone, especially any other Latinist friend, has ever tried. You've succeeded in making me take a reflective look because I'm from Chicago.
Ooh.
And I am one of those Chicagoans who's very touchy about the whole second city thing, because I'm like, no, New York is not better. Nowhere is better. Chicago right. should be number one, always and forever. And now that you've compared it to Rome, and it would be like, if you were a Roman, it would be like coming from Chicago and ancient Greece being like,
and because they're always looking back to the East. And then so this came in my head because studying Roman art, I mean, they talk about it. You know, you probably know this tradition of like studying Greek sculpture, but you're looking at Roman copies the whole time. And it's not until you talk to someone outside of our field that they're like, well, if they're Roman, why are you studying them as Greek? And you're like, good question. It seems very obvious they're Roman. And I think that's where the Chicago kind of second city, like chip on the shoulder, really came at me as a Romanist. Like, why do I have to study the statue of Venus as a derivative of a 5th century thing made like 600 years ago? You know, it's very interesting. And there's been a lot of like good work with Roman so-called copies, and that they're not just imitative. They're doing new things. They're kind of tailored to look a particular way, like little kind of variances for a specific context. So good work is happening there. But yeah, I feel you.
Oh, wow.
I'm thinking like, now you're going to have to, I don't know, you're going to have to start reading about Roman stuff. You're going to have to take a course.
I know. I'm going to have to
cross
like,
over to the dark side. I'm sorry.
I don't think I'm in danger of crossing to the dark side, because I have such a long history of my absolute love of it. But see, like yeah. your early oh, but, experience with Rome, with, yeah. with going there and feeling this attachment, that yeah. was me with Greece, because I didn't okay. get to go to Greece until the summer after my freshman year of college. But like the minute I landed and I got there, I just had this immediate like sort of scent settle over me of like, I'm home.
Yeah. Well, and it is magical. And like when you feel that, you know, you have to like, you got to do something more with that. Like it's real. So my thought is the happy medium is Imperial Greece. You can work on the Greek world in the Roman era. There we'll meet in the middle.
See, it's so funny. That's what I told myself about when I was young. My 6th grade teacher taught this fabulous unit on Egypt. And so actually when I grew up, I from 6th until I basically got to college as a freshman thought I was going to be an Egyptologist. And so when I wanted to mix the two, everyone was like, just study Hellenistic Egypt. And I remember thinking, no, I don't want to do a mashup. That's horrible.
You don't want to do the Ptolemies? Come on.
I was like, it's too late. And then I was like, it's not like true Egypt. If you're going to do Egypt, I was like, no, you should just do actual, real Egypt. And I said that, of course, with all the authority that one could muster as like a senior in high school could, right?
Right.
Not knowing that that is not true, and Hellenistic Egypt is still Egypt very much, but at the time, you know, it's like being a know-it-all. But you know, there's so many funny things that you don't realize until later. Like I think one of the things that made me not like Rome was, you know, I'd read Homer in high school. I had to read Homer a lot in undergrad because we were always doing something with Homer. And then I remember I took like a Roman lit class or something, and we read the Aeneid. And I was a sophomore, and I remember thinking, this is a freaking ripoff copy of Homer's work, just in opposite order. Aeneas is nothing special. No. And then that was kind of the end where
that
I was
ruined
like,
it for you.
It ruined it. No. But I've had Latinist friends tell me, no, I can walk you through the Aeneid if you want, and I can tell you why it's special and it's different, and you should see Rome differently. So I'm coming around.
You're coming around.
I'm becoming more tolerant of the Romans, but you know.
Right. Well, and what you have to think of and what is good for you is, I don't know if this is a good or a bad thing, But the Romans do appropriate a lot of that Greek stuff and they keep it going forward, you know? So like part of the reason we can do so much with the Greek world you love is because of the Romans for all their horrible, they're basically horrible. All major powers are, I guess. I get for better or worse, they took over the Greek stuff. So yeah.
That's true. But you know, they brought some really fascinating new traditions, which I admit I find fascinating, which is funny because I have a lot of Hellenist friends who will not admit they like or find anything fascinating about the Romans. So I'm better than that. So I can admit they brought some really cool new things. Now, I did read up and I did see that you specialize in domestic art. And now one of the things I want to ask about domestic art is when you say domestic art, right? Am I talking like paintings and things they would have on their walls? Am I thinking pottery or am I thinking anything that would be domestic and could be interpreted as art? Like the thing I'm really fascinated in is the household shrines with the Lares and everything.
Yes.
And I was like, because this is not something we see in Greece. And I was like, like the hell? They have like a shrine, but it's for like the dead.
Right.
So yeah, do you kind of encompass that or no?
Yeah, so I use the kind of like domestic art to be very broad. So you're totally right there. And that's because like, how would you say it? Like my dissertation, I cut my teeth on like sculpture. So I still work on sculpture. I like paintings. I've published on paintings. I think it's okay to admit this sometimes. I feel like there's like this push against the aesthetic, but like I like pretty things. It's okay that I like the pretty things. I've started to think about like I like domestic art and space because I become, the more I work with this stuff, I've always been kind of interested in like who's it for, who's looking at it, who interacts with it, like how does it shape space? So I'm interested in like the kind of things, the conversations, the people who inhabit the domestic. So there's the populations there. And with your thing on Lararia, this is really interesting because this is like this kind of place where some of my other interests come in. So I don't know how this kind of happened. Like I think trained in a way that it was very traditional up until recently, where you look at these objects as though they're for the elite, they're by the elite. And in some ways, I think that's actually problematic when you think about most of our domestic corpus that we know as Pompeii. Not all those houses are like super elite. They're like, I don't know what would be members of a middle class or middle classes or so this is like a kind of popular culture or way of decorating your home that I think more people participated in than we sometimes think. But with the Lararia in particular, a lot of times sometimes those shrines are like off the peristyle or something, but other times they're kind of in like tucked back, I guess, kind of by the kitchen. And we do think that kind of like this household cult, so like the genius of the family and the Lares, the kind of daily kind of maintenance of this cult was probably practiced by like the enslaved staff. So I think this gets at different ways that, yes, of course, it's built for the family who owns the house, but it's probably maintained and interacted with most by the people who work in the house, probably forced to work in the house. And I like those kind of spaces as a window into different populations that if you read your traditional account of the Roman house, you don't really think about. You hear about the elite owner who sits there during the day and welcomes people into the atrium. But then the Lararium in the back, that's probably where the enslaved staff kind of keeps up the family standing, at least among the gods or in a kind of religious context. And the cool thing is I actually work on, my book project is on late antique villas, but villas also, especially in the late antique period, there are cult sites associated with villas in earlier periods, but they really kind of like take off in the late antique period. So if you work with villas, this is the best place to kind of explore like different kind of later permutations or iterations of family cults. So people build these large mausolea that have like little niches on the wall. And oftentimes the sculptures aren't there, but maybe they're used for portraits of the family. Maybe they're gods too. Maybe it mixes kind of like family and so-called pagan or more traditional cult. And then some of them are later converted to like Christian structures. There's just like this layer of religious space that I find really, really kind of fascinating. And often on villas, they're either like, if they're attached to the residential quarters, they're a separate entrance, or they're at the, like the far extent of the, like, we can't figure out how big a property was, but they're removed from the residence. So I do think they're these weird spaces that, again, like in an example like Pompeii, a Lararium that's off the kitchen that's probably run by the enslaved staff, on a villa in the provinces in the late antique period where there's like a mausoleum / worship cult sites, it's probably a space for both elite people, but more sub-elites, whether they live in the area or work on the villa. It's probably a space where they all kind of pass through. So I'm like really drawn to these the way the domestic kind of like it spreads into other areas of life, like religion in the Roman world. Yeah. Does that make sense?
So yeah. No, it's really cool. And it got me thinking about so many different. Well, the first one I want to address, though, is it's totally fine to say you like pretty things because
okay,
I had a grad TA my freshman year of college, and mm-hmm. she was TAing for like it was a sort of the general introductory freshman art history course where I think it's ancient to medieval art was part one, and then part two was like the medieval to modern art was part two or whatever. But obviously hating contemporary stuff, I was like, I'm not going to take part two. I only want to take ancient to medieval because I like ancient art.
Yeah, yeah.
But my TA, they kind of just, I don't know how they split it up, but basically my TA, her area of emphasis was 18th century French art. And I just remember asking her, this is interesting. So you're teaching me about ancient art. So why are you studying 18th century French art? And she said, because I like frilly, pretty things.
Oh.
So I said, okay, that's valid.
Right. I love that she just came out with that. That's good. And I should say my, my like anxiety about that, or like that being my tell or whatever it is. I think it's because as an archaeologist, I think it's the Indiana Jones thing again. Like you're expected to get in the dirt and be like, and I've done that. There are parts of me, times in life where I enjoy that. I do like to dig. I should say I really like to dig. Like I'm at this point in my life where I have two kids. It doesn't always work out. And I think also there's so much stuff that comes out of these excavations. So there's sculptures, there's like the ceramics, there's the coins, there's so much stuff that it's okay to work on stuff and not dig up more stuff. I don't know. I kind of like have this archival excavation. Like I'm finding things that have been uncovered years ago that people forgot about. And there's something about me that's drawn to like certain objects have stories to tell. And I can't necessarily tell every story or intuit what, I don't know, the whole like if these walls could talk thing. Can't quite do that. Like don't have those skills as an archaeologist, but there's something to be said for going back to objects that we've already brought up, which I think is maybe linked to more this like bigger kind of zeitgeist about like what we're doing with our planet and how we take care of the world. And for every excavation, there's like three previously excavated sites that have been forgotten about. So
no, it's true. I mean, I think it definitely gets lost if you're not an archaeologist or if you're not someone who is just aware of things that happen in the field. Because I think when I was traveling in Paris with friends of mine, we were joking about, you know, I said, where do you want to go? And she said, and my friend had never been to Europe before, and so she said, obviously I want to go to the Louvre. And I said, well, that's fantastic, but I said, you're gonna have to pick and tell me what exhibits you want to see, because here's the thing, this museum is huge. And I think someone did the math and they calculated that if you were to spend literally two seconds in front of every item, it would take you 2 years to go through everything that's just currently on display.
Oh my goodness.
And so that is shocking enough. And then I told my friend, I said, well, you know, for all of those things that are in the museum on display,
right,
there are boxes and boxes and crates and shelves of things that are not on display, that are waiting forever to go on display or may never be on display. And
unless some archaeologist of some cultural period comes and finds them and writes something about them.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I was like, we do kind of forget that, like, once we find all these things, and I know it's exciting to sort of be the one to go and dig up and find new things. And I know it's exciting. Believe me. It's what everyone wants to hear. But I was just like, where do you think it goes? Because it cannot go. When people say, oh, yeah, but I'll just go into a museum. I'm like, where? We have museums that are overflowing. Do you want to spend more than 2 years in front of everything in the Louvre? Because that's two seconds on every item.
That's crazy. I don't. I thought you were just going to say, like, even I, as someone who likes stuff, I like things, I like looking at art, I fatigue in a museum after a couple hours. Like, my goodness, 2 years, though. That's like,
I know. Wow. And that's like not even spending the time to read any of the little plaques. I mean, that's
right.
two seconds.
That's crazy.
I know, right? That's why I'm like, can you believe, trying to imagine that on a scale of like literally calculated 2 seconds at an item that's walking by, glancing, and like walking on. It would take you 2 years. So yeah. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Wait, so I got to ask now, do you remember what you two went to go see? Like, what did you look at then when you were
Luckily, because my friend is not, she was one of the rare friends who was not also an ancient studies major of some kind. Nice. So okay. She said, you're the friend from my friend group who likes the old stuff. So you tell me, what do you recommend? And I said, I can recommend to you other than the big pieces.
Right.
I just said, walk through the entire Egyptian collection and walk through the entire Greco-Roman collection. And she was happy to do that. Although I think she was kind of sad. She wanted to see some of the more like Renaissance-y type. But I was like, no. That's too young. I don't do that. You can go see it on your own time.
Funny. Next time you're there, I think my favorite piece in the Louvre is like, I think it's there. I'd have to double check off the top of my head. But it's like when I went there last, I can't remember when it was, but it was like pre-COVID. So who knows how it's changed. But it was down in the medieval galleries. And it might have been like Northern Europe medieval galleries or something. It was like basement level. And it was quiet. So it was like, this is one of the least popular ones. And there's this wooden statue of, I think it's Mary Magdalene, that's painted. And so it's wood. The paint is still preserved. I remember she has long hair that's like covering her breast because she's nude. And this like blew my mind. It's like, I think it's 13th century or something. I was like, wow. And I found this kind of cool because, so many of the discussions of like the old cult statues in our world are like, they're like old wooden things or something that don't survive, right? And so like seeing this like helps me kind of imagine like, oh, there are all these different sculptural traditions that like we don't have preserved in our world because the wood doesn't last as long. But so next time you go, check out that one.
I will. No, I'm
going to the basement somewhere and find it.
Yeah. Well, and that's going to be the coolest place, especially if you're there in the summer where it's so hot. But no, wait. Oh my gosh. Yes. Wait, you mentioning the wood. Okay. That sparked a thing. So I know in Greece, because that's my experience. Now, I'm excited to learn if this is a thing that you find in Roman material culture as well. But one of my favorite statues is the Athena Parthenos, which was in the Parthenon. 40-foot tall, Chrysalis Elephantine. She's gorgeous and beautiful, but her base was wood. She had a wooden base. And, the statue from its height, when it started to come down, my favorite fun fact about it that I always tell my friends when I want to impress them with facts is when Athens would struggle, they would go into the Parthenon and they would take pieces of gold literally off her drapery and use it like a bank. And I was like, this is so funny. But then eventually when all the gold was gone because Athens was poor and they had all the wars and the plagues and all that stuff and the ivory was gone. But there were stories of mice living in the wood. So you don't even get the base anymore. So nothing is left. So do you have stories of like mice destroying Roman
spaces? No, I'm sorry. The first thing this makes me think of is there's an excellent children's book called, what is it called? The Log Princess and the Little Wooden Soldier. Okay. And without revealing the end, it very much depends on bugs that live inside the workings of the little, he's not wooden. I'm sorry. The princess, the log princess is wooden. And the robot is like a robot. But still, there are little bug animals inside that do something cool. But in my world, the only thing I can think of is like, we still have those like big acrolithic sculptures, like, the famous Constantine, like head and hands and stuff, because probably definitely wood body. But I don't have any awesome stories of like little mice I got to look. I'm trying to think. This would be in like a novel or Suetonius maybe or something. But as far as I know, no, that's one where, okay, Greek world wins in that section of mice in sculpture stories. You win. You get that one.
Woohoo! Not that Greece needs to win anymore because they're already so awesome, obviously.
Obviously. But
because you have such wide interests. I was like, okay, so there's like the material, there's the sculpture. And then as you were mentioning your love of, the domestic and the sense of spaces. Now, when you say spaces, just for clarification, is that like physical space or is that also the more metaphorical like liminal spaces of the mind?
That's a really good question. I think it's usually what I mean is like the physical space. Like, so the physical space of like a house or a villa is where I feel like that's my bread and butter. But actually this is an interesting thing. So this last year in Rome, I did this tour of tombs, like Roman tombs, with a friend and fellow Jasmine Hearn, who's a wonderful like many things, like choreographer, dancer, artist, doula also, like, and archivist, like, amazing. They do everything. But we did this tour thinking about like tombs, both as like, they are kind of like the domestic, right? Because for the Romans, those are like houses for your ancestors, houses for the dead, the whole necropolis thing. But then we were trying to lean into these as like liminal spaces, right? Because families come to the tombs to worship their ancestors. They like interact with the deceased who are somewhere else. Like the tomb is like this liminal space for those kind of interactions. So I haven't published on funerary spaces, but I teach them a lot, right? I was working with them a little in Rome because my villas are mostly in the provinces. So, and Pompeii was a little bit of ways away. So what would I say? Like, I am interested in like, yes, actually space is like physical space, but also as this kind of the liminality of space and who, like what is domestic? Because the tomb things that I'm talking about now, it makes me realize domestic is not just in the home. Like domestic is, you see it in different parts of the public world, whether that's in tombs or just like the imperial family on display in certain spaces, which is probably why I always stick with the like interested in the domestic, domestic archaeology, so that I have a very wide umbrella, not a box. I don't go into a box. I can stand under an umbrella. It's a very big one of what I like to think about or research. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no one wants to put their work in a box, but also luckily, the nice thing about what we do, right, is that it's so interdisciplinary that like you can start with something that seems really narrow. And then you'll like, as you're going forward, you'll be like, oh no, but actually, and there's more, and there's more,
yes,
and there's more.
I think that's so true. And I think that's a like, I don't know if you found this too, especially with like working on this podcast and then like your work too at UCLA, but when you're in a classroom, it's kind of like, you think there's certain things I'm supposed to think about. And when you're in a degree program, there's certain things I'm supposed to think about. And then when you kind of leave that, you're like, I can think about all these other things that are like related, but not actually what I said I was interested in, but actually I am interested in it. So I find that part of like post PhD life really, really fulfilling, I guess. Like, and some of the things I stumbled, like, and I say domestic, because so knowing that you're interested in cult stuff, one of the things that was most fascinating is like, so Pompeii and Herculaneum, they get like all the press down in the Bay of Naples. But this last time I spent the last year in Italy at the American Academy in Rome on the Rome Prize. So that's why I was there. But I went down to ancient Capua, and they have two really good museums, and they have this huge collection of these statues, the Matres Matutae, that are like these women sitting like on a throne type thing, and they're votive statues, and they're holding anywhere from like 1 to like 12 babies. And like, it's not totally clear what they're for. Like, they're, are they supposed to be like kind of worshipers of like, I don't know, Kibele or some sort of like, I don't know, fertility cult? Or are they votives, people hoping for protection of their children or children to be? But it's domestic, right? It's like women and children. So I'm like, oh, I want to do something with that at some point in my life, and it's part of the domestic. So.
No, there's so much that you can literally shove under your umbrella. Well, yeah. As you're talking about, I mean, this love of domestic, which I find really fascinating, mm-hmm. right? Because I think also probably part of what soured me on Rome was that for whatever reason, maybe it's just because, you know, one of those unique things to you're in college. It just seemed like everyone who wanted to do Rome didn't want to do something like really impactful that kind of, you know, could help relate to what we wanted to do or that we think of in our everyday. Like, everyone just wanted to do like Roman military strategy or just study, you know, Caesar or Augustus, right. But just the more stereotypical things that you think of. And so I got really soured on it because I was like, oh, another person who wants to do Roman military history. How boring. Something like that. So no, it's exciting to like, yes, I like the idea of the domestic, and I do like, you know, religion and cults and things.
Right. And the religion thing is so interesting because I've never thought of myself as someone who's like working on religion or interested in religion, but it's just because religion is everywhere. Like, there's no separate religion. It's like part of everything. So like, as you said, there's cult in the Roman house, there's cult on the street, there's like sites for cult, there's like sacred groves and shrines, like all of these spaces, even the villa, like when they laid out a villa, they would kind of mark the boundary with this like kind of sacred ritual. So like everything is sacralized and
I can't study anything without it touching somehow on religion. But it's because religious life, it makes sense. Religious life is like such a big part of the ancient world. And like, but to them, it wasn't even like religion. It was just
no,
life.
It's just part of it. So, and I should pick your brain on this. Like, I have a hard time kind of like teaching this to students. And like, usually like I go through, I don't ask students how they like religiously identify, but I kind of talk about how like we have this idea of like monotheism, you know what I mean? And most of the students I interact with, they are like, they're either Muslim, they're Jewish, they're Christian, or they don't necessarily identify in any kind of way. And the kind of getting people to fully wrap their heads around like, not even just like a polytheistic religion, but religion that like, you don't, there's nothing about belief, really. It's just like all around you. It's like engaging in these things. I have trouble like getting this across to students, and certain students understand this. Like, I've had students who, like a Hindu student who's like, I totally get it. I get it. You know, like I follow this. But then I've tried to, it's like the analogy of like, I used to say it's like brushing your teeth. You just do it. It's part of life. You take part of this. Like, you don't overthink it. You just brush your teeth. Right. And then it's twice a day. And I was like, but there's so many more little, I don't know. I guess it's kind of like our curse words. Like, they just pop out. Maybe it was, I don't know. I have trouble sort of conveying to others like how much this permeates every part of life in the Roman period.
If we wanted to be realistic about it, mm-hmm. brushing your teeth is kind of a ritual. We just don't think of it as a
right?
ritual. But it is, because what do we tell kids? Okay, kids, we're going to get up. What do we do when we get up? We go to the bathroom. We brush our teeth. We floss. We do all the things. And then the same thing if you're putting kids to bed. Okay, now we go to the bathroom. We brush our teeth. Like, it is a ritual.
Right.
It's just, it's not religious, but it is a ritual.
But it is, and it's a similar kind, like, because it's a ritual that you do to, like, prevent bad things from happening to your teeth, right? It's like,
Well, and if we were in ancient Rome, instead of, you know, the sugar bugs or just the bacteria, we know, we would be like, and the little demons are going to come and they're going to rot your teeth out. And do you want to not have
teeth? Your top won't grow. And then the so-called barbarians won't
attack. Like, it's the little demons, or it's the god of, you're going to lose your teeth, or the god of beauty will strip you of your beauty, which means you'll lose your teeth. You know, you could make some excuse for why it is what it is. That's the thing I love most about studying domestic culture for these, you know, it's fun to study. It's really funny, because I was talking with someone just the other day who said, I'm so tired of people just studying kings. No more elites, no more kings, this, no more emperors, that, no more anything. I just want like domestic people. What do we relate to? And
really?
I was like, I get that, because it's all we get is like, it is. It's just like dribble from kings. Okay. And I did this and I'm so great. And now I did this and my armies did that. And now I'm king. And you're like, great. Does that tell me anything about how you lived? Not really.
That's interesting. And I do think, I don't know if that person's in the Roman world. I do think the Roman world has gotten a little, sometimes we're stuck. We're either doing like senators or we're doing the enslaved. And like, there's value to studying both populations, but there are also like so much variety within those populations. Like, I don't know, if you're an enslaved child, you have a very different life in a house than an enslaved person who works in the mines in Spain or something. I think what we need to do more, especially in my field, is, and it's hard, right? It's hard because sometimes you want to contribute to these big overarching discussions of like, what was life like? Diachronic change, like social patterns. And you can some ways do that best by like, I can tell you a tiny little corner of the story based on this one site and the evidence for this population. But I've gotten more and more into, I work on villas. So there's always like this specter of the elite owner, but I'm into this idea that like elite is, it's a lazy term. Like, it's a lazy term that we use. It's like, so I was just reading this thing this morning, the scholar Kim Bowes discusses like elite as like the sieve that we pass everything through. And like, we seem to know what it is. And like, what is elite falls out the bottom and we all get it, right? But I think there's much more variety across that. I think there's variety across the enslaved. And I think there's this whole population like in the middle that is like, I don't know what you want to call them, middle class, peasants, artisans, tradespeople, something that like, that's so cool, you know? And like, how did those, and the thing I'm really drawn to now, and I'm trying to do with my book, like a bottom-up approach to the villa. So if you look at these sites as like places where elites live, but also the people who worked the sites, the people who passed by them or used them as like rural nodes, basically, you can look at many more population groups. And if you kind of bring them into the narrative, I'm kind of interested in like how we can rethink, because you know, the way we tell history is usually big sociopolitical changes, right? And those things happen. But I think we've forgotten about like the majority of the people and how they might contribute to those kinds of changes. So I think not only is your interest in moving away from kings important, I think it's like necessary to understand better why things happen or why history is happening in the way it did, you know?
I will agree that it is definitely easier with Rome, because also you just think about kind of like our even pop culture. There is, someone said this the other day, and I can't remember who it was, probably someone I was podcasting, but it was so brilliant in the moment that I didn't even realize how brilliant it was. Yeah. But we were talking just about contemporary culture and how I said we live in, especially in the last 10 years, it's like the renaissance of classical material, where suddenly everyone wants to do something ancient world. And so I said something like, we're saturated in Greece and Rome. Uh-huh. And we don't see a lot outside of that. And I think I was bemoaning like, oh, we don't have enough Mesopotamia. But then they said, well, if you think for a minute, all the Greece stuff that we mostly have mm-hmm. is based off of just the mythological material. They said, how many series or anything can you think of that's based off of like domestic Greek life? And I said, nothing? No one? I can't. Mm-hmm. I was like, Clash of the Titans, Perseus, mythology. Yeah. Next. Like nothing is, but on that same vein, they were like, but think about Rome. Yes, we have a lot of, you know, Roman mythology stuff like Hercules. We have so many adaptations, but right. they were like, HBO Rome,
yeah,
Spartacus.
You definitely get into that.
They were like, that's like more sort of, it gets to the domestic or the experience of a slave. And yes, you know, it's made for Hollywood because you fight and it's glorious, but
right.
even something like Gladiator, they were like, it shows you more than just.
Yeah.
And I thought about that for a hot second. I said, oh my gosh, for the first time ever, wow. So now I was thinking, you know, Greece is doing great. And I'm like, no, because right. nothing shows like Greeks.
And you know what it might be like? Okay, so I'm thinking like another thing that comes to mind is like, so you can get all these like books for whether they're for like all ages, honestly, like scholarly books, but also kids books, or you could take a class on like daily life in ancient Rome, right? And they go through like the stuff of quotidian living. And I think you could do that in some ways for the Greek world, but I'm trying to think. So like the best site that I know for like domestic is the site of Olynthos, and it's been studied, right, as a for like daily life. And I think one of the major readings, I forget if this is Nick, I think this is Nick Cahill, but each of the houses, it's not so much Nick Cahill. Nick Cahill does this cool stuff on like how each house is kind of like self-sufficient. Like there's stuff to make their own cloth, and they kind of take care of themselves. You have to think that they probably have like, I don't know, countryside that they farm, because it's still like an agro town. But the houses are so regular. So it's the opposite of Pompeii. They're like very, they're all like the same size. There's the same plan. And I think the problem is the early excavators of that site used it to read in this like democratic ideal that we think of as so iconic of the Greek world, right? The Athenian democracy, like even the cities were built in this democratic fashion so that everyone has the same size house. And so I think it's maybe just that, I don't know, like the Greek world is so rich in like burials and religious sites and like civic architecture, civic donations. I think that domestic is often sort of like left aside in terms of excavations, because many people have this idea as like, I dug a house. What more can I say besides it's a house? You know, like how does this contribute to those big sociopolitical narratives? And so that's something like, I don't know. In your future, as you go on, as you talk to other people at various levels working in the Greek world, that's something to like, I don't know, push everyone to think about. Like, how could you rethink what you do have in Greece to have more attention to the domestic? You're right. In terms of reception, though, I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Even the things that pop up, it's like, I don't know. The Colosseum pops up all the time, I guess, Pompeii. It's because you don't have, well, that's the thing. You've got Atlantis, but I guess that's like mythical. But it's also definitely maybe Thera. You've got some Thera Santorini stuff that you could play with. But
I mean, there's a lot you could play with, but it's just, it was so jarring because I was like, no, but what's been done?
Right. And,
I mean, I would love to have like an HBO Rome type of thing, but for Greece.
Right.
Because
right.
we have the evidence. No, yeah. just no one is doing
it. Well, maybe this is like, there are people like up and coming to work with this stuff. Like one person, you should look into Camille Acosta, who's a Coatson grad.
Oh, I know her.
Yeah. So she's studying burials of migrant populations, and especially when possible, like women and children. And if you think about that as like it's a permutation of the domestic, right? Then maybe this will get your fix for ancient scholar, but then you'll have to like convince her to do reception or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, There's so much there. There's so much there. Well, okay. I mean, I know we're getting into the media section, which is great. But okay, to get us a little back to, I am curious to know. No, it's fine. I love these tangents. But I am curious to know, though, out of all the media and the things we have that, you know, are about Rome.
Yeah.
As someone who studies it, do you like watching things about ancient Rome, or do you just get annoyed because, oh, it's inaccurate or doesn't look good or whatever?
Yeah. So, I mean, here's my sort of thought. Like, I think, what was it? I think the story with like Gladiator was that, I don't know, the classicist who was called in to like consult on it was like frustrated that they didn't follow her recommendations. And then she wanted her name removed from it or something. But I like that stuff. I think it's important to have like a positive attitude to the reception of this stuff, because I mean, if that communicates the material in one way to an audience that's not familiar with it, isn't that great, right? Maybe they'll take a course in it one day. Maybe they'll go on with it. Maybe they'll visit those sites. Maybe they'll help kind of like think about that material in a different way. And I would say my thinking on that has really changed. I like Gladiator. I like that movie. I thought that was a good movie. I'm like, no, Commodus doesn't kill Marcus Aurelius as far as we know, but who cares? Who cares? It's TV or it's like a movie, you know? And HBO Rome, there are parts of that I thought like, whatever, you have to understand. It's like, it's a drama. They're doing what they want with the material evidence, which itself, I should say, the literary evidence that we have, the documentary evidence, is fragmentary. So you're allowed to take some space if you're not writing like a research paper, right? That's fine by my account. And I actually liked in the HBO Rome, like they must have poured tons of money into that. Like I liked the costumes. I liked the set. My one critique of that is there's a scene where Caesar does a triumph, and I usually show it to my students. I'm like, this is what a triumph is like. I think it's too solemn. Like, I know there's like the religious air to it. I think it's too solemn. I think it would have been like the parades after like Super Bowl victories where people are like really jazzed up on victory. So I show it as like, here's all the people involved. Here's the ceremony. But then I also show like whatever the latest Super Bowl victory is. I also show that to be like, there's also like gross like party parts of these triumphs, I'm pretty sure. But I like the reception, and I think it gets into, I told you I spent this last year at the American Academy in Rome, and like it's scholars in the humanities broadly, so like in ancient studies, but also architecture, art history, medieval, Renaissance, modern Italian, and then all in like the arts, so like people doing everything from like visual arts to like landscape design and landscape architecture. I gave this tour I already talked about of the tombs, and there was like this motif in one of the columbaria that we visited, this like kind of geometric motif that an artist later, a week later, showed me she used in one of her kind of prints. And I was like, this is beautiful. This is like a form of reception. And artists have done this for years and years and years, whether it's in poetry or in the visual arts. And like, we never are really negative about that kind of reception. So why are we so critical of like a movie that it's not like Gladiator sells itself as like the historical truth of what it was like to be a gladiator in Rome. I think you just have to enjoy those and have fun with those and realize that it introduces new audiences to this world that you know very well, but their kind of take on it can help you think in different ways. So I'm into those. I love those. Even the Disney animated Hercules, I kind of like that one. I hate the song Go the Distance. I think that's a bad song, but
oh, interesting. Well, see, I can't be impartial only because I grew up with the Disney Renaissance, and
oh yes, yes.
And so, you know, I'm a 95 kid, so yes. That was like being made right when I was a kid. So I did grow up with those, and so being kind of like inundated in Disney everything.
Yeah.
I can't, like, if I observe it now as a scholar of the ancient world, I'm like, wrong, this is weird. Right. Why is this like, there's so much like weird undertones of like a biblical morality, Christian morality. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I could analyze the shit out of it. But at the same time, I'm like, no, just turn that part of my brain off and just enjoy it.
The best thing on this note, like, I don't know if the Penn Museum still does this. So I was a grad student at University of Pennsylvania. And when I was there, the Penn Museum started to do this. Like, so what was that big movie that came out with, like, was it Troy? I don't know. Brad Pitt was in it.
Yeah, Troy.
Yeah. And they were showing these ancient movies, and they would have, a classicist and then someone else, like usually grad students who would use, like they would talk during the movie with a microphone and call out everything that was off and like make jokes. And that is the best way to do it. So I think we just have to organize one of those events because then it becomes really enjoyable.
Yes. Yes. No, like, this is what I'm talking about. You just, you put on like a shitty ancient world movie and then you get a bunch of classicists in a room and then you just talk about,
yes,
why
and
this
it's
is
enjoyable.
Bad.
Why it's bad. What's wrong? Actually, this makes me think this would be a really cool creative final. Like, let's just watch the Hercules movie and write up all the things that are wrong for me. And we'll see how much you've learned during class.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Your final paper is a full analysis of Disney's Hercules. Go. Yes. Yes, I'm behind this. Please teach this and then we'll do an experiment.
Although I don't ever teach mythology. So we got to pass that on elsewhere. I'll like, and I kind of love HBO Roman Gladiator, so we can't critique those ones. We'll do that Last Day of Pompeii movie. That's like,
yes,
kind of great and kind of bad. Yeah.
No, it's all bad. Yeah, no, yeah, no. There's so many. Well, there's a bunch of other like shitty Hercules movies.
Yes,
there's so
there
many
are.
Shitty ones.
There
so
are.
You could take your pick.
I know. This is a whole class here. I've already, and all we do is write. And then it is, you know what it is? It's actually one of those writing intensive courses. You just write critiques the whole time from the perspective of an ancient studies person.
And so it's ancient Rome and Hollywood, ancient Roman, yes, media, ancient Roman something, and make it writing intensive. And then,
yes,
everyone just writes a critique of every single film and
so
what's wrong with
and
it.
Everyone would come out really negative and really critical, but some other professor can deal with that down the line.
Exactly. See? So no, we've created a new class. Now we have to figure out how to get that made. But okay, so there are a lot of bad ones, granted.
Yes.
But
yeah. What's my favorite? So if I'm honest, I prefer to watch like fantasy that is not ancient. Like I went through a serious Star Trek phase. I really like the Marvel stuff. I'm like very into it. I like the Star Wars. I thought Andor was like one of the best TV series I've watched in a long time. So I think that's where I go with my, and then maybe it's because in the back of my head, there's like, this is wrong. When I watch the ancient stuff, I get more out of these purely fantastical worlds, right?
But is it easier with like books? Like you mentioned you have kids.
Yes.
Are they into the Percy Jackson series at all?
They are not. So they're young. They're like five and almost five, almost two. So still little.
Okay. So they will eventually hit that phase.
They will. Yes. And I kind of wonder. So like the problem was my daughter spent her year age four growing up in Rome and being dragged throughout Italy, throughout parts of to various museums to look at the ancient collections. Right. And I'm into the Greek sculptures too, when they're, most are Roman copies, but still. and she in particular, I remember like she was cool about museums in like October. We get to like April and I remember I dragged her to the Basil Diocletian and she just gave me like the biggest eye roll I've ever seen. Like, I don't even, like her eyes don't even feel like they could do that. And she was just like, oh, I don't want to look at more of these boring white sculptures. They're all the same. And of course I was like, they're not, there's little differences, but touche, I get your point. And she totally changed. I mean, so I kind of think she's not going to do it. You know what she found really interesting? This is fascinating. If she goes into anything, I think it'll be like medieval art or something, because we would go into churches and she's a tall kid. So she falls down a lot and is like always got bonks on her knees, or we call them bonks. But she, the first time, and we're not a super religious family. So the first like cognizant time she was in an Italian church and like, you know, they're overly decorated. She was drawn to the images of Jesus on the cross because Jesus has all those bonks. And she goes, that's so interesting. And I was like, do you find it like, I remember being like, you like that, Talia? Is that pretty? She goes, no, it's interesting. Because, and the first time, you'll love this. The first time we went in there, she was like, is that Achilles? We were like, no, no, that's not Achilles. That's Jesus. Like, sorry. I feel like there's, who knows? So I don't know. She knows about the ancient world. She knows about myth. We're not pushing it. The last year she probably felt pushed into it and she rebelled. So we will see. We will see what happens. But
it's so hard. It's so hard, isn't it? Because like as someone, as a scholar of the ancient world, all you're like is I want them to be happy and do their own thing. But also I kind of really do want them to.
Well, and I
want to
share the like, there's certain things I do want to share. Like, I think there's potential because I don't know. My gateway was myth, right? I don't know if that's a lot of people's. That's Percy Jackson. she's really into these books that do like, I forget what they're called. I wish I knew what the name of them was, but one's called Pirates, and it's stories of pirates from different cultures throughout the world, like mostly older cultures, but some contemporary. And I'm like, well, there's Pompey and the Pirates, like Sextus Pompey, right? Maybe she'll get into that one day. And there's books on like Prince. So she's into stories. I feel like that's, we'll see. We're going to let her find it. Like at some point, I'll probably have to buy that same myth book that I had. And then we'll just see if she picks that one or pages through it, you know?
You should, because Dodelaire's was like how almost everyone got into it. Because that's like the famous,
I know,
like, book. That's just, it's Dodelaire's. It's so famous, you don't need to say anything other than Dodelaire's, and everyone goes,
yes. Mm-hmm. Well, and it does have those cool illustrations. There's this, like, these kid ones that, like, a friend got for us when she was born, actually, that is, like, the little, it's, like, this one about Medusa, and she has to brush her hair, and she won't brush her hair, and her hair's, like, a fright, and her grandma walks in and is like, ah! So that's the kind of myths we have right now. But, oh, and then the Midas one is really cute. He likes to paint everything yellow, right? And then he paints his stuffed animal, and his stuffed animal is not soft and stuffy anymore. But don't worry, his mom comes in as the Deus Ex Machina and washes it in the washing machine.
You know, I'm realizing that there's so much crossover material between receptions. Like, there was the Aladdin sequel that I think it went straight to DVD. Because most, unfortunately, of the Disney Renaissance, like the good ones that were for genuine 90s kids.
Oh, yeah.
Most of the sequels went right direct to DVD.
Right.
So here you are in Agrabah. So it's clearly Middle Eastern. Duh.
Right.
And then they did. So spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen it. So the whole premise of the sequel was Aladdin finding his family, figuring out what happened to his family and why he was on the street to begin with in the first movie. They figure out that his father.
Let me guess. He's a prince, right?
No, he was the leader of the 40 thieves.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the 40 thieves. And they have like this whole magic premise where his father's after like the treasure beyond treasure. So you're like, okay, I don't know where they're going with this. The treasure is Midas's hand.
Oh, my
God. A golden
goodness.
Thing that turns everything to gold. And it does. When they find Midas's hand, literally, like, they touch everything and it turns to gold. And I'm like, this is reception.
Right. What? Well, and then you know what's interesting about that? It's easy to be like, whoa, 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 whoa. Those things don't. But it does get at the thing that I think we're moving to in all these kind of, like, Mediterranean fields, that there's much more, like, cross-cultural interaction than I think we thought there was. You know what I mean? So I'm not saying that, like, the ancient Persians had a Midas hand that they – but they did interact with that world. So I don't know. This is a positive spin on this. It sounds like a horrible sequel. I'm sorry.
It definitely was not great. I think, well, all I know is the only reason I wanted to see it is because Robin Williams returned to voice Genie for the sequel. So I was like, okay, if Robin Williams is in it, I'll watch it. Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, most of the sequels, honestly, for all the Disneys were like terrible. The only one I really liked was Lion King 2, but that's only because Lion King was always my favorite Disney movie growing up.
Lion King is so good. Lion King
which
is
itself is based on mythology.
Yeah, well,
but I think from
it's
Japan.
Hamlet-y, right? Hamlet?
It's Hamlet, but also I think someone like analyzed and said there's like a Japanese myth or something that also is kind of the same themes. And I was
in
like,
there too.
Oh.
Yeah.
So everything's based off of mythology.
It is. Well, everything's in conversation with what was before, riffing on it, building on it.
Yeah. Well, I'm like, one day I'm going to be interested to see what your kids get into. Because I think the thing is, Percy Jackson also is kind of later just because, I mean, it's supposed to be YA, but like I was 12 turning 13 when I read the first book, and that's the same age like Percy and Annabeth and all the characters there. They were also 12, so that's like the age where you would read it and relate the most. So just wait until your daughter's 12,
right?
And then
here's a good thing. I feel like we are in the generation of students where that's what people grow up on. So like, yes, there's Dodelaire's, but most people it's Percy Jackson. That's how they know it. And I've never read Percy Jackson. So what we did in Italy, we got the first one and we brought it home in Italian so we can practice our Italian and also know the Percy Jackson series. So
that's fantastic.
I know. It'll be really slow going. I don't think I'm even at like 12-year-old Italian level yet. I'm a little farther down. By the time I finish, maybe I'll be an 8-year-old or something.
Well, let me put this. For someone who's into the Roman stuff,
yeah,
the original series is basically all Greek. There's like a vague reference here or there to Roman stuff, but they usually use the Greek iteration if there is.
Okay.
If you read the sequel series, which came out a few years after the fifth book of the original series, mm-hmm. That's where they bring in the Roman demigods, and they have, instead of just Camp Half-Blood for the Greek demigods, they introduce this whole thing about actually on the other side of the country in, and I think it's in California too, but in California, you have Camp Jupiter where all the Roman demigods are, and then it brings together the Greek and the Roman demigods, and so you get both sides. And so I tell my Latinist friends, if you're into the Roman stuff and you want to hear from the Roman demigod children,
right,
read the sequel series, because then you'll get a mixture of both and not just the Greek stuff.
But see, here's the thing, I still like the Greek stuff. I mean, and the best, I don't know, Ovid's Metamorphoses, right? Those are all Greek stories. They're just told in Latin, right? And all the mythological wall paintings, I mean, I don't know, the myth is Greek, you know? It's like the one myth I work with, I don't even know if it's myth, what you'd call it. In the Roman world, there's Pero and Mycon, which is this like story of filial piety where she nurses her father, or sometimes her mother, wasting away in jail. It's weird. So it's better to stick with the Greek. Is my thought. Like, I'm going to stick with the original Percy Jackson. On this note, though, let me show you something really quick. I realize podcast listeners can't see this, but I'm really into Playmobil, right? And do you see this up here on the top of my
office? That. So what we are seeing, dear listeners, is a row of Playmobil like
all 12 of the Greek characters. Gods. Yep.
Oh my gosh, all 12 gods.
I know.
Oh my gosh. That's
and if dedication. We're gonna get critical, they're not really well done. Like some of the costume choices are bad, the hair choices are bad, but like Zeus, for example, is sitting there with a bald eagle, which is like they must have had the leftover eagle. But I still, you'll have to visit in person one day to like see them.
Yeah, I want to come see, because
in real life, because they're awesome.
Because I had professors with, I remember my, before I move us to the end of this podcast, because I know we'll be here forever. No, I love it, but we will be here
really
until we're 100.
Just keep going.
Right. But so what I'll say is one of my favorite professors of undergrad, mm-hmm. she was on the older side. I think she retired like 2 years after I graduated. Okay. She was in her mid-70s by then. She had all these great sort of tchotchkes in her office. And one of them, I remember, I saw my either sophomore or junior year, and I remarked upon it. Mm-hmm. It was an action figure of the Cyclops from the Hercules movie.
Oh, nice.
And I just remember thinking, I love it. So I commented on it a billion times. So when she retired, she emailed me and just said, I know you're coming down for homecoming. Would you like to stop by my office? Because I'd like to give this to you.
Oh,
and I said, yes, thank you so,
so
much.
Great.
So I have it. It's at home. It's in my closet. But I have my little Cyclops from her office.
Bring it to your office. You got
to. I know. I need to bring it. I'm
like
waiting.
People who put the tchotchkes in their office. I think that's important. And as you show, like, students like it too. They like, it's a talking point, you know. And
it's reception.
For the whole office hours thing, yeah, it's reception. It's talking point. It like gets the mental juices going. So
exactly. Well, you know what? This segues perfectly into, so the last questions for the interview portion of the podcast are: when you were a student, either in undergrad or grad school, did you go to office hours?
I did. Not that much. No, I was bad. But what I did go to instead was, when I was in undergrad, we had like a small group of majors, and we would get together for like what kind of felt like office hours, study hours type thing. I didn't know. I was a bad office hours kid. I didn't go.
No, it's fine. You know, most kids don't go. So.
I know. Well, and it's because here's the thing, like, and this is what I think is so beautiful. I didn't realize this until I was talking with you before we started recording. I didn't realize that office hours could be like this. And it was being on the other side that I realized, like, the way I talk about what I do or scholarship, I don't talk about that just all the time. Like, that's not how I live my life. It's like fused in with other things. And I didn't really realize that that could be how an office hour conversation goes too. Like, you don't need a problem. So I think what you're doing with this podcast is really beautiful. Like, I think that's great.
Yeah. No one knows. But and that segues again perfectly into, you know, now as an educator yourself from the other side, right? Mm-hmm. If you were going to give like a 30-second elevator pitch to students for why they should go to office hours, what would you tell them?
I would say go to office hours because it gives you a chance to connect with your professor as a person. And most people do like to chat about not only what they work on, but other interests. And often if you're drawn to a subject and someone else is too, there's that point of intersection, but there's also others. I don't know. One of the biggest skills from like getting a degree in classics in particular, I'm going to rep our field, but also the humanities is the ability to talk with people and to converse and to like kind of put your thoughts into words. Like that's a skill that we don't put on our resumes or our CVs. And yet it's a huge skill. And you can practice that in office hours with a professor. And if you're scared of them, like, I don't know, most professors are a little scared to interact with like cool undergrads too. So whatever, find the weird tchotchke in the room and talk about that first, and then you'll get going.
Exactly. No, I do love that about our field. I mean, it teaches you, studying any humanities, but really also like the ancient fields, you learn to be a good conversationalist also, because it's awkward if you have a room of people who just study like all these artifacts and cool things, and if you don't know how to talk, it makes for a really weird interaction. So yeah, definitely learn how to talk.
Right. Funny, that's great. Good, like office hours and social skills. That's definitely something to take from it.
Very good life skills, transferable skills.
Yes.
But so at the end of each podcast, I ask if every guest will read Shelley's Ozymandias poem. And then after you've read it, if you would just tell us, you know, like this poem has been cited as quite influential or quite beautiful and it sticks with people. And I would just be curious to know, you know, does it stand out to you? Does it stick with you? Do you agree with kind of what people have been saying about it?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I remember I took a class in like, what was that? Like 18th, 19th century English poetry in college. So I read this at one point in time, but I have not read it in like years, I think. Okay. Ozymandias.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Embark on a digital exposition unlike any other with Hit Points in History. Dive into the captivating realm of archaeogaming from the comfort of your screen, March 9th and 10th at our virtual archaeogaming conference. Join academics, professionals, and gamers of all levels on an interactive journey through live streams, workshops, and collaborative gaming events. Whether you're a seasoned adventurer or just starting out your quest, there's something for everyone. Your adventure awaits at Hit Points in History, March 9th and 10th. To buy tickets and find out more, head over to hitpointscon.com.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the stone, half sunk a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Asmandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty in despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. It's a beautiful poem. What would I say? I'm going to admit that I don't remember why or what was supposed to stick out in that poetry class when we read this one. But what strikes me now, especially based on the conversation we've had, I really like that it's, I don't know, I'm reading some sort of like inscribed statue, some powerful figure, but there's that reference to the sculptor who's interpreting these people and these lives. And it's getting at things that we said, like, ah, don't just tell the stories of kings. Like, think about the other people. They're in this poem there. Also, who's the traveler? Who is the eye and the sculptor? I mean, the only named person is the King of Kings. But I like that there's all these other kind of persons, population groups, identities in there. So that, I know that's resonating with me in my current interests and what I want to pursue. And I love that it's like a sculpture, right? It's I'm feeling sometimes I go away from sculpture, and there are points where I, like my daughter, don't find Roman sculpture super, super interesting, the mythological stuff. But then I always find my way back to it somehow, so that I'm finding that in here too. I don't know. And then, of course, the meditations on like what survives, what remains, what is lost and what is found. That's kind of in my head now too. What are your thoughts? Yeah. Can I ask you, Lexi, if you've read this with many people, like, tell me about your connection to this poem and how that's maybe changed.
Well, I read this poem for the first time. Now, clearly I can point to high school. I definitely read it. Now, I feel like I might have read it earlier than high school, but because I don't remember that so much, I kind of stick to high school. But it is stuck with me because it just indelibly had an imprint from the first moment I read it. And I said, this is the most beautiful example of romantic poetry, but also I liked it because it got to the very nature of like what is important, what the themes of monumentality and legacy, and also because I have a huge interest in political science. It was very political. I'm like, you know, Shelley wrote it in 1818, and this was after he knew that the statue of Rameses, that was one of them that was recovered in Egypt, it was going to be transported to London to be in the British Museum. And so Ozymandias, when I looked it up in high school, I learned that that was the Greek, the Hellenized name of Rameses II, and of his throne name, Usermaatre or Usermaatra, either one. And so it got me thinking, and I was like, oh my gosh, all these generations. So you do have the way that it's beautifully composed, but then you also have these layers of, you know, he's using a Greek name for an Egyptian pharaoh. And yeah, and all these themes kind of came to the fore. And so for me, it kind of struck me as a memento mori because of the sculptor. Yeah. Because, you know, this king is basically saying, I am the greatest ever and you will remember me and my civilization will last 1,000 years. He's gone. His civilization is dust. And we wouldn't remember him if it weren't for the sculptors who made the statue. So it's kind of saying you can't succeed without the little people. So don't leave anyone behind. Don't mistreat anyone. And it's interesting because the language of the poem says it's sculptor, implying one, when I'm like, this was ancient Egypt. Oh, yeah. This was probably many sculptors. Right. So all the language kind of like you know, unwrap the layers. Yeah. And so it's this like hugely detailed poem. So for me, definitely memento mori and this reminder that, you know, nothing is permanent. But also then you think, well, even though the man died and the civilization crumbled, we still found a sculpture, right? There's a lot of art that didn't survive, but it's still there. So then it's kind of like, okay, so it's kind of impermanent, but it could be permanent.
But it's so fragmentary, right? It's like if you've got that, but what else isn't there? And yeah. What? No. And no, I like the contrast. I don't know. I like, because you drew attention to this. I like the sands. Like, I don't know. And I know, I can't remember. I think Egypt is maybe the Nile is not too much changed from like the Roman period in which I know it. Like the sands live on. You know what I mean? Like it's this kind of nature versus like art, that kind of like dichotomy that you see in so many things too. And I like that.
Oh, yeah. No, the timelessness of the landscape layers. Or something. Yeah, like you could teach a whole class in this poem. I honestly think you could, because it's so deeply layered. But obviously, you know, those are just the quick things. But see, because I like all these themes that come to the fore, yeah. right? The last question I ask every single guest on my show is, if you think about our contemporary society right now, do we have a modern Ozymandias? Like something that we think is so great and permanent and monumental, but like realistically, will future humans like 500 years from now agree with right. us, or will they just see kind of like remnants?
See, I wonder, my current thought on that is like the things that I find, I don't know. I think the Ozymandias statue is like our phone or something. Like, I don't know, these things that like, whatever the data we're putting in the cloud, or I feel like the world has changed. Like our present moment is, I can't think of a physical thing that is out there that everybody is so drawn to besides their phone, which is a weird kind of, I don't know.
It's true. I mean, that's a valid answer. I love it when people say technology, because I think it is true. I mean,
well, you know, right. And you think about like this thing that has survived. I mean, that's ancient technology, like the making of this image of a man that he no longer lives. His memory, his legacy is barely there except for this. It's cool.
Oh, yeah. No, it's so multi-layered. And that's why, because it's kind of like one of those hard ones that you can't really, no one can really answer that question, which is why I ask it, because I'm not looking for an answer. I'm looking for
you've got to have collected like the coolest assemblage of thoughts on this poem after like all the people you've talked to. It's like, you could teach this course. Yes, you can.
I know, it's like a master. It's making people read it to me and then tell me their thoughts as I then get to improve my own thoughts on it. Yes, it's been a master class in Ozymandias. So I guess I'm the Ozymandias expert at this point. But I kind of lied. There is one more question I'm going to ask you. And that's where can people find you if they want to, you know, find your work, email you because they want to take a class. Yeah,
I'm an assistant professor at UCLA in the classics department and also the Coatesyn Institute of Archaeology. So you can find me here in Los Angeles. If you're at UCLA in Los Angeles, I'm also what's called faculty in residence. So I live on the Hill among the students. So you could like see me in the dining hall too. And if you're like an other person out there, I use my UCLA email, which is my first initial S and like my last name Beckman at humnet.ucla.edu. Funny story. I have two Instagram accounts because I got locked out of one because of two-factor authentication. So I had to create another. And the problem is they're both private now because I put pictures of my kids and like, it's not clear which one should be work and which one should be personal, but at some point, you will be able to find me on Instagram as either S Beck Eliz or S Beck Eliz 2.
Well, when you decide which one you want to make the public one so they can follow your professional life, we will find it and link awesome. It. We'll link everything okay. in the show notes. And do you have an academia page?
I do. I think it's just my name. I don't know how you find it, but it's just my name at UCLA. Yeah. And I don't – I was going to say my faculty page is where I link most of my articles because I – just for students on there. So like,
great. Okay. Well, that will be linked to the show notes. So if they want to find you, they can.
I love chatting. So reach out to me.
Yeah, please. Yes. I mean, I'm sure they'll want to come see your collection.
I've got so many more. I've got like, they did the Roman. So I've got like the Roman centurion. I've got some gladiators. I got, this is only available. It's not available in the US Playmobil, but the Asterix and Obelix Playmobil set. So come visit. Seriously.
I wanted those. So
you have to travel. I feel like you can't get them in North America. You have to.
Yeah. No, I've only seen them in like France or other places in Europe. So anyway, okay. Thank you so much for coming to chat today.
Thanks for having me. Thanks any of you who are listening.
Trireme Transit is now departing ancient office hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.